succeeded, everyone.
And good morning and welcome to all of you. We're very happy to see everyone here today. We want to thank the National Judicial College and the University of Nevada for hosting the Nevada Court of Appeals for our first session outside of an official location. Normally we are in Carson City or Las Vegas, and so here we are today in Reno. I am joined with Judge Jerome Tao to my left and Judge Abby Sutter to my right. We have had oral arguments, I believe, in 11 cases so far, so this will be number 12. And thank you, counsel, for agreeing to also conduct the argument at this location. We have a lot of guests here today. We invited members of the judiciary from Washoe County, the bar from Washoe County, also any judges that were attending the Judicial College. The Judicial College is in session this week with the General Jurisdiction course and an ethics course. And we are all proud graduates of the National Judicial College, too. In Nevada, all judges are required to attend the National Judicial College, and district court judges must attend the General Jurisdiction course. Each of us are former district court judges. I attended that course on general jurisdiction in 1995, and it was a three-week course. Judge Stover and Judge Tao attended a few years later. I think it was down to 2 weeks when you took it, wasn't it?
Yeah. 2 weeks.
2 weeks. So, but it was an outstanding course, covered every aspect of being a judge. And we're all new to the appellate bench, having been appointed in December, and the appellate court was created by the voters in November, and first actions were on January 5th of this year. So we've been really busy. We're really excited about the work that we're doing and to also to be here today. We were able to select two Reno cases for the argument. We actually had a third case set for 11:30, but that case had to go off calendar. Any of you that choose to stay all the way through here, we are going to take a question and answer session. We'll have one after the final argument. And so feel free, particularly if there are any students or anyone that's considering a career in law. Obviously, we won't be able to talk about the merits of the cases that we hear today, only procedural issues or court in general issues. So we'll get started now with the first matter that's on the docket. This is case number 62047, City of Reno versus Jacob Vidian. This is an appeal from the city from an order that was granted by the district court in which the judge ruled that the jury verdict should be set aside. And we'll get into the specifics of that in this argument. And there were several different people at the lower court actions on this. And now is that Mr. Dunnigan?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. We're very happy to have you here today. The arguments are 15 minutes, and you can reserve time for rebuttal out of that 15 minutes if you care to.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thanks.
All right. Then we'll proceed with the argument.
Good morning, Judge Gibbons, Judge Silver, and Judge Tao. I'm Mark Dunnigan with the Reno City Attorney's Office. I'm also here today from the City of Reno is Detective Bernie Lemaire, who you will recall was driving the police cruiser to the hospital in an attempt to save plaintiff's life when the car was struck in the intersection with an off-ramp off I-80. We're here today because the district court made a mistake and overturned a jury verdict in a way that was both procedurally improper and also substantively wrong. And as this court knows, the right to a jury trial is among the most precious rights that we have as Americans. And a jury verdict is not to be overturned lightly, and it's not to be overturned without the specific standards for doing so having been met. And importantly, it's not to be overturned because we as lawyers and judges may disagree with the outcome of the jury. And so the district court's error in this case can be boiled down to a couple of different arguments. The first is that it was procedurally improper to grant this relief. After the jury returned a full defense verdict, The plaintiff moved for judgment notwithstanding the verdict and new trial and additer. Now, Rule 50, NRCP 50, governs judgment as a matter of law. And Rule 50A provides that before a case is submitted to the jury, at the close of either party's evidence, a moving party can move for judgment as a matter of law at that time. And if that party wants to move post-verdict, it's governed by Rule 50B. And what Rule 50B says is that that motion must be a renewal of a timely filed Rule 50A motion. And the 2005 drafter's notes to the amendment to Rule 50 are very clear that 50B is only a renewal, and the exact language is that that renewal must have been preceded by a 50A motion.
How do you distinguish that from the Avery case? I mean, do you feel like somehow the 2005 amendment somehow overrules Nevada Supreme Court precedent in Avery and Gilliam?
Well, I think Avery is still very clear that where a party fails to move for a directed verdict at the close of evidence, the question of the sufficiency of that evidence is not reviewable where the party didn't preserve the issue of its sufficiency by a properly filed directed verdict motion.
Well, they reversed and remanded in that case, and that's Nevada Supreme Court.
It's also not in the context of judgment as a matter of law. The Avery case and the Price case and the Francis case, for that matter, are all briefed by the parties. Those are all remanding for a new trial, which is a much different remedy and much less severe.
So let me share that. Brings you to my question. The motion that was filed below after trial was a motion for a new trial or, in the alternative, for a judgment as a matter of law. Yes. Now, the district court appeared to grant the GMOL and then granted a new trial as to damages or additor. So what's your position on what the district court did with the rest of the new trial motion? Has it been granted? Was it denied? Was it granted in part? Is it still out there?
I believe that the new trial motion was only in the event that the parties, that the defense parties did not accept the additor. So I think if we were on remand, we would be back down there talking about whether we wanted to accept the additor, and then there would be no new trial. That's the way I read the order.
That's what the judge said in his ruling, but Judge Tao's asking about the motion that was filed by the plaintiff. The motion was motion for a new trial or, in the alternative, set aside the verdict and grant judgment as a matter of law.
Yes, Your Honor, and the district court, it correctly identifies the standards for both judgment as a matter of law, that one being whether a party failed to prove a sufficient issue for the jury. And then it also identifies the standard under Rule 59 for a new trial, and that standard is whether the jury manifestly ignored or misapplied a jury instruction that results in a manifest injustice. And now, while both those standards are identified correctly, the order goes on to not apply the Rule 50 standard. And in fact, the exact language of it is, the jury manifestly ignored or misapplied the law, therefore judgment as a matter of law is granted. So there you have the Rule 59 standard for a new trial used to grant Rule 50 relief for judgment as a matter of law. There is no precedent that allows that. And I would also point out that the plaintiff had experienced trial counsel that knew how to properly file a post-trial motion. Plaintiff did so with respect to the mitigation of damages and the sudden emergency doctrine. And I would suggest that the fact that plaintiff didn't challenge the sufficiency of the evidence demonstrates that they knew that there was sufficient evidence to support a defense verdict.
How is it not a manifest injustice in this case when you have a granting by the district court of partial summary judgment for the plaintiff? So the only issue for the jury is which defendants or to what extent are they negligent?
Well, again, for judgment of a matter of law, to defeat that motion, the non-moving party only has to have presented sufficient evidence for the jury to return a verdict in its favor. And applying that standard means that the court would have been required to view all evidence and draw all reasonable inferences therefrom in the light most favorable to the city as the non-moving party. And so the order doesn't do that. In fact, it reads quite the opposite. It reads like it's cherry-picking evidence and reading it in favor of the plaintiff. Had the court applied the Rule 50 standard correctly, there's ample evidence in the record to support what the jury did. For instance, the order says that the trooper, the NHP trooper who investigated the accident, described Officer Lemire as reckless. That is flatly wrong. That's not what the record says. The record shows that the trooper was asked hypothetically, would it be unsafe or reckless?
So let me ask you this. Given that your argument appears to be that the district judge is mixing two different standards here, you argued a minute ago that he applied the Rule 59 new trial standard to grant a Rule 50 motion for judgment as a matter of law.
That's the way the order reads, yes.
So let's say hypothetically, if we would agree with you, what's the relief that you're asking for? Do we hand it back to the judge to consider the new trial motion properly, or what is it that you're asking for?
We're asking that the jury's verdict be restored because there was sufficient evidence in the record to support it. A new trial would be improper. There was no manifest injustice in this case.
You were about to describe what you thought was a discrepancy between what the trooper said and how it was represented to us. Did you want to finish that thought?
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. The trooper had, he was asked hypothetically, would it be unsafe to enter an intersection without looking? And he said yes. And then later on cross, he was forced to admit that hypothetical did not apply in this case, that he didn't collect any evidence as to whether Officer Lemire looked down the off-ramp, and in fact, he didn't even ask him whether he looked down the off-ramp. And meanwhile, there is evidence in the record that he did look down the off-ramp, and that's the testimony of Officer Lemire, who...
Well, on respondents' brief, though, they've cited to the record where they said that Trooper Stapleton was of the opinion that Officer Lemire's conduct in proceeding through the intersection without first making sure it was clear was simply unsafe and careless, maybe even reckless,
and so,
to the record.
And you're
saying that that's just clearly a hypothetical?
No, I would argue that...
taking that out of context?
Excuse me. In deciding judgment as a matter of law, it's the jury's province to weigh the credibility of the evidence. The district court said, oh, the expert testimony clearly showed that he didn't ascertain that it was safe to enter the intersection. I think that's an error, because weighing the credibility of the testimony and the evidence is the jury's province. And as long as there is a shred of evidence, the W.V. Prima case, cited in the brief, says that where there is evidence tending to support a verdict, or where there's a conflict of evidence. In other words, if Officer Lemire said, I acted safely, and then you've got conflicting expert testimony, and no physical evidence, by the way, that conflict means that the judgment as a matter of law must be defeated. It must be inferred in favor of the non-moving party. The record is full of inferences that could have and should have been drawn in favor of the city as the non-moving party. For instance, there was evidence that he looked down the off-ramp. There was evidence that he slowed down. Both Officer Lemire and the eyewitness, John Broderick, testified that as he approached the intersection, he slowed down several miles per hour to proceed safely. And the court instead cites to John Broderick's written statement just that he ran the red light. But the court doesn't bother with her much more specific deposition testimony that he did, in fact, slow down before entering the intersection. And as to the court having been persuaded by the expert testimony, I would argue that each one of those experts was impeached in front of the jury by a defense counsel. For instance, Trooper Stapleton had to admit that he didn't even collect evidence as to whether the officer looked down the on-ramp. Kent Buckner, who was an accident reconstruction expert, he had to admit that his measurements of the scene were taken from an undisclosed internet source that he didn't bother to confirm. I would argue that that impeaches his credibility in front of the jury. And that inference was required to be drawn by the district court. And there's just no evidence in the record that those inferences were drawn. The jury could very well have found in this case that it was possible to slow down and look down the off-ramp that day, with the light being what it was, with the color of the car, with the off-ramp coming at an angle and a gradient, coming at an unknown and undeterminable speed, because the cars were moved before there could be any physical reconstruction of the speed, and nonetheless getting to a collision. And there was no jury instruction that precluded the jury from finding that. In fact, the district court rejected the instruction that plaintiff proposed, that one is presumed to see a plainly visible approaching hazard. And when that was offered to the court, the district court correctly said, the plaintiff is free to argue that, but I don't think it's a correct instruction of law. And that's in the reply brief. In fact, the instruction that
they were also told to presume, and I have the jury instructions right here, they were also told to presume, as a matter of law, plaintiff was not negligent at all. And still did not find any negligence upon either of the defendants, even though, based on the facts, there was evidence presented by plaintiff that Officer Lemieux was unsafe.
There was evidence presented by the plaintiff, but there was also...
And JASA. JASA's expert, Brian Jones, also said that he was going about 34.4 miles an hour and was unsafe.
And so you've got two experts conflicting, because I believe Stabelman found his speed to be between 20 and 25, and there's another expert saying, oh, it's up to 45. But most importantly, for this analysis, there is evidence that he was driving 20 miles an hour, and the court is required to draw that inference after the jury has returned a verdict in favor of the defendants. So the conflicting evidence, it's just contradictory evidence is to be disregarded.
For the non-moving 3 minutes now. Do you want to reserve that time?
Oh, this is my total time? Yes, I'll reserve that time. Thank you.
Like in district court, these arguments are short. We spent a lot of hours already looking at all the papers, though, so it's not like we haven't heard what you said. All right, we have Mr. Jensen appearing here for Mr. Bedian. Is Mr. Galloway going to speak also?
He will, Your Honor. What we'd like to do, if we can, is divide up our time, 7.5 minutes each. I was going to try and focus on some of the procedural issues, and Mr. Galloway would address any factual issues the court might feel.
So you're going to take the harder part? Give him the easier part. Well, you already heard the issue as framed by the city attorney. Do you think that's accurate, that it's simply under the rule that the motion has to be made in the district court first because you're simply renewing the motion after trial, so you have to make the motion during trial?
I don't, Your Honor, and there are several reasons for that. The motion that was brought followed a motion for summary judgment in which Mr. Bedian was found not to be at fault at all in this case, and so there were really only two players left. There was Officer Lemire and Adam JASA. It went through a jury trial, and when we were confronted with that issue, that point in time just before the jury, the close of evidence, I should say, there was an issue of apportionment, and so because we had that issue of apportionment, and I knew that perhaps may require a jury decision on that, it didn't seem appropriate at the time for us to be moving for a judgment as a matter of law on liability.
Let me ask you this with the apportionment issue. These facts are similar to Avery versus Gilliam as far as the facts. The district court in this case found that as a matter of law, assigned a 50% liability on each of the defendants. What authority, what law can you give us that the district court had the authority to make such a determination as to the percentage of negligence of each defendant as a matter of law? As a matter of law, the district court wrote 50% on each. What authority can you give us to say that that was correct?
Well, there's two cases out of the federal courts. There's Buchanan versus City of San Antonio, 85 Fed Second 196, and U.S. versus Valco, 720 Fed Second 885, which gives the court, the trial court, the power to grant affirmative relief on a motion, a JMOL, if you will, in a situation such as this. In fact, those cases concerned an even more early determination by the court, where the court was making a judgment as a matter of law before the defense even had an opportunity to present evidence in the case. And they discussed the uneasiness they had, you know, say where a trial court judge would grant a judgment as a matter of law, say even after opening statements. But in this situation, what we have is the trial court heard the full evidence in the case, and then after the trial court heard the evidence in the case and the jury returned a verdict absolving both defendants in this scenario where there's only two defendants that could have really caused the accident, the trial court took it upon itself under Rule 50B after our motion to go ahead and render judgment as a matter of law. There's a little bit of a lead up to this, and that is that
When we filed our judgment for JMLL, so to speak, in the trial court, the opposition that was filed by the defense never raised the issue of you have to first bring this motion first in the trial at the trial court level, and by not actually doing that, they waived that argument later for a post-judgment, post-verdict motion. More particularly for this particular court, is the court is really hamstrung because as I read the record on appeal or the appendix of the city, the opposition and the transcript, which was a substantial transcript on the argument for the motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, was never provided to this court. And that really hamstrings this court in trying to determine whether or not Judge Flanagan's actions were correct or incorrect, because what in essence the city is doing here is the city is criticizing Judge Flanagan's ruling on our motion based upon its objection and the arguments raised in the court below, but then has not provided this court with the opposition or the transcript of the arguments. Under Cousy versus Community College System of Nevada, 123 Nevada 598, if an appellant who has the responsibility for providing the record on appeal to the appellate court doesn't provide certain key components of the record, the appellate court is generally presuming those missing items to be in support of the district court's ruling in this case.
Unfortunately, we've had to look at that case many times in other situations. Why, again, is it so important that this is missing?
Because the court doesn't know what the position was. It doesn't know what was argued in the lower court.
We have the order, the district court's order.
Right.
And if he says, I mean, you know, aside from whatever individual arguments you made in front of the district court at the close of the evidence, okay, if as a matter of law it's not proper to bring a post-trial motion for JMOL unless you brought one at the close of the evidence, if the district court judge says in his order no motion was brought, what more do we need on at least that single isolated procedural question?
Right, and well, the point I was trying to make with that particular, with the order, is that the order of the district court doesn't reference any objection by the city that we didn't first bring this pre-verdict. So by not objecting to our pre-verdict motion, they've essentially waived our any objection that we didn't first bring it before the verdict was rendered.
If Rule 50 says that you can only bring a post-trial motion, which is a renewed motion, based on a motion brought earlier, your position is it's okay for you to do that, notwithstanding what the rule actually says, so long as they don't object to it?
I think it's incumbent upon the city or anybody who's opposing such a motion to object to it at the time, so the trial court has an opportunity to take that into consideration and say, I think that this type of motion should have been brought before the verdict was rendered in the case. Notwithstanding those points, which are procedural, certainly, we have two cases in Nevada, Price versus Senate and Avery versus Gilliam, which allow the district court judge to hear a Rule 50B motion, even though there wasn't a 50A motion brought earlier, if there is plain error or manifest injustice.
That's an interesting legal question, because both Avery and Price were pre the 2005 amendments, right? And the 2005 amendments specifically removed that language that the old rule used to say you could bring a post-trial motion whether or not you brought it earlier in the case. But the 2005 amendments specifically removed those words. That was the purpose of the amendment. So isn't it an open question whether Price and Avery are even still good law?
There may be an issue there, but as I have always understood the JNOV or Rule 50 motions, you really had to bring a motion before the verdict came in order. In other words, you had to renew it later on if you wanted to preserve that. If that isn't indeed the way this court views that, what I would suggest is that it's really unfair to the practitioners of this state to say, okay, well, the case law heretofore has been from our Supreme Court that in the case of plain error or manifest injustice, you don't have to bring a 50A motion before you bring a 50B motion, and now the rules have changed,
based simply upon an alteration of the procedural stat or the procedural rule in this case. So I would say that if the court is inclined to say, hey, okay, we're going to draw a bright line rule here and say in every single case, irrespective of situations where there may be an apportionment issue, the practitioners have to bring a 50A motion before they can bring a 50B motion, such a ruling should be prospective, because the people, the practitioners in this state are going to be relying upon the Supreme Court's ruling in Avery and Price v. Bennett.
Well, you're saying that there's still good law at this point, despite the amendment to...
I do. I think it's based upon a federal court decision, the DeFrance decision, which has never been criticized or overturned even in the federal courts.
It's at least an open question, because you know, if you've done any research that we have, you know, it's interesting that since the 2009 amendments, the Supreme Court has done nothing with the amended Rule 50, so we don't know what their view of it is.
That's true.
That's true. Didn't those cases have a remedy of a new trial rather than judgment as a matter of law?
They did, Your Honor, but what was going on there was the trial court in those cases had denied the 50B motion. And so really all the appellate court was left with was trying to remedy a situation where there was no judgment as a matter of law by the trial court. And the remedy available to them was to send it back to the district court for a new trial. In this particular case...
Why didn't they just remand it back and tell them to enter it as a matter of law? They found it shocked the consciousness. Why not send it back for that ruling?
To be honest with you,
instead, it was a new trial in both of them.
Sure, it was. To be honest with you, Your Honor, I don't know what was going through the Supreme Court justices' minds when they did that. I do know in the, I believe it was the Price versus Sinop case, one of the justices said, I think we should just go ahead and enter a directed verdict right now to avoid this whole problem. But maybe what was going on in the justices' minds in that situation was they were thinking, this is really a decision for the trial court who sat and listened to all the evidence, observed the witnesses, and it's really more appropriately for a trial court's determination. In this particular case, Judge Flanagan actually did that. He distinguished it. This situation is distinguished.
Where did he get the different percentages, the 50-50? Did he find that? He decided it.
He put that in the editor part of his order, not on the liability part, but he said if you get a new trial on damages or just defendants pay 50-50 with the amount Judge Flanagan said.
The Supreme Court cases, though, that we're discussing didn't have two defendants in there.
Correct. I think Judge Flanagan was perfectly within his rights to make an apportionment issue, particularly in this situation where you have a negligence-free passenger and two actors in an intersectional collision where one or both are responsible. He's heard all the evidence. He made a decision based upon what he found.
I know you're a strong advocate for jury trials, though, and as Mr. Dunnigan pointed out, I mean, isn't that really the jury's role?
Well, the reason we have Rule 50 is to remedy miscarriages of justice. That's the whole purpose of the rule, as I understand it, and reading the philosophy behind it. And so what I think Judge Flanagan was doing is he saw a miscarriage of justice and stepped in and said, I'm going to utilize Rule 50B to remedy the situation.
All right. If you want to give Mr. Galloway a chance, they're in there.
I'm going to switch tracks and talk about Rule 59. The appellate review standard under Rule 59 is palpable abuse. So the question I think you all have to think about, or questions, was it palpable abuse for Judge Flanagan to disregard the testimony of Officer Lemire that he drove safely? Was it palpable abuse for Judge Flanagan to disregard the testimony that Jasser wasn't there? We all know Jasser was there. The accident happened. Was it palpable abuse for the judge, the trial judge, Judge Flanagan, to disregard the testimony of the witnesses that defy the laws of physics, the laws of nature? This case obviously centers around what I call the Code 3 statute. That's NRS 484B700. Under that statute, Officer Lemire is required to do two things. He's required to slow down as may be necessary for safe operation, and then the more important provision that I think is applicable to this case is the provisions of this law do not relieve the driver from the duty to drive with the due regard for the safety of all persons. And that's the critical analysis here that I think Judge Flanagan was getting to. there's a lot of discussion about speed. Speed is a factor in this case. Speed is important in this case, but it's not the determining issue. The issue here really is that Officer Lemire failed to comply with the statute when he looked. And all of the evidence is that he looked. In fact, his testimony, which would be page 758, volume 4 of the transcript, is, yeah, but like in the situation here, you can see. You can look right down the lane. You were looking right down here. So what does the city do with this? This is the problem with the city's case, is that the city says that the jury could have inferred from these facts that somehow or another, to borrow their phrase, the contours of the ramp somehow come into play and obscure Officer Lemire's vision. Officer Lemire testified that he could see. So that can't be used as an excuse to not comply with the statute. The other excuse that's offered by the city in its brief is that somehow the demands of the situation, the emergency situation, weigh on Officer Lemire to the point that he misperceives JASA. That's not an excuse. Under the statute, he doesn't get an excuse. He says the only inferences that can be made in this case, if we're going to talk about inferences, and that's the city's case, is that the judge has to give all the inferences, the benefits of the doubt, to the city. But if you listen to if you look at the testimony and the evidence that's been presented to you, there's only two inferences here: that either Officer Lemire didn't look down the ramp to see oncoming traffic, or two, he looked, but he looked carelessly. Under either one of those scenarios, he hasn't complied with the statute. And that's the problem with the jury's decision, is that the evidence on the second element of the statute is uncontroverted.
And why didn't you move for a directed verdict?
That, I was hoping that my colleague, Mr. Jensen, would have addressed for you.
Do you want to switch again?
I'd be happy to, because I don't have an answer for that. I think you're correct that we, at that point, perhaps, I mean, it's hard for me not to acknowledge that. That's something that perhaps, in retrospect, if we retried this.
I don't doubt that. It's an argument.
But I'm focusing on 59. That's 50.
Galloway, sorry. You need to wrap it up now.
All right. Sorry. I think you have to. What I've raised about Officer Lemire looking, I think that's the issue you have to factual issue you have to focus on, and then apply the palpable abuse standard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dunnigan, another 3 minutes.
Yeah, I have to move quickly here. The statute, NRS 484A, which was also jury instruction 26A, that statute does not require perfection. All it would have to say, if it did, is that emergency vehicle operators aren't allowed to get into an accident. It only requires them to act reasonably. And plaintiff's own expert admitted that it was possible to look down the ramp and not see Jason. That alone defeats judgment as a matter of law. That's the only piece of evidence, truly, without all the other arguments that I've made, that shoots down the argument that statute means that as a matter of law you have to have seen something approaching. And again, that instruction was rejected. JASA's expert, Brian Jones, also testified that there are numerous stimuli in an emergency that can interfere with an officer's perception. That, again, is an inference that should be drawn in Officer Lemire's favor, that he did slow down, that he did look, and that nonetheless, based on the circumstances, he just didn't see the guy coming. If I could go to the waiver argument that Mr. Jensen raised, this is the first that we've heard of a waiver argument that they were free to raise that argument, but you said didn't do so.
So they waived the waiver argument.
They waived the waiver, exactly. But what I would say is that the rule is still a rule. And for example, if an order granting summary judgment was before you and you identified some glaring issues of fact, regardless of whether those particular issues were raised by the non-moving party, I would still expect you to overturn summary judgment. So nothing changes what the rule is about when you have to bring that motion. Senate and precedent
it doesn't say what plaintiffs want it to say. It doesn't allow a...
It doesn't say what you want either. This is a new trial, which is not your position, and that is the Nevada Supreme Court law.
Well, but again, to go to the palpable abuse standard, a judgment or granting a new trial is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard, and that has been stated under Nevada law to be an exercise of discretion that's improvident or without due consideration. The record is full, and my arguments are full of things in the record that the trial court did not duly consider. That is an abuse of discretion. And so, to the extent that he's granting a new trial, this court should not allow that. I think I'm done.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Dunnigan, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This case will be submitted to the court for a decision. We have to discuss it further, consider the arguments that were raised today. These proceedings are recorded, and then double-check the various points in the briefs and in the record. So a decision will be at a later point in time. We thank you all for the excellent job done by each side.